Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello, and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. On today's show, we'll feature the second of a two-part interview with the noted author, film producer, and blogger, Danny Schechter. We'll also present a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a report about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Internet pioneer Dave Hughes is hanging up his web spurs this week after 23 years of providing internet access in Old Colorado City. The 79-year-old retired Army colonel, known as the Cursor Cowboy, began offering email and other services in 1984. Hughes started one of the first computer bulletin boards in 1980 to foster community discussions about politics. He named it Roger's Bar, after a watering hole he frequented.
It's the New England Town Hall over an electronic back fence in Colorado. That's what Roger's Bar was. Millions of people in America can talk directly, unfiltered by media or any other intervention, and as a consequence can make up their mind by not just what they see in the paper, what they hear on the radio, but also ask questions and get answers and make up your own mind.
Hughes hooked up poor rural areas to wireless internet with grants from the National Science Foundation. He tells the story of how he connected up the schools in the little town of San Luis, Colorado, where U.S. West wanted $2,000 a month for a T1 line.
So I go down there with that grant, buy two of these frequency hopping radios, and connected them up doing the same thing at zero added cost.
Hughes has helped broaden access to the net from towns in Montana and Mongolia to pubs in Wales and even the base camp at Mount Everest. He says that using unlicensed wireless spectrum is creating a device-centered, worldwide revolution in how people communicate, and it's very cost-effective. So how come local, state, and federal government hasn't gotten on board with his ideas?
It's not the devices. It's the uses. The phone companies hate this. Free communications? Are you kidding? AT&T wants to take the money in. The idea that I can sit here and communicate free to somebody else is a direct threat to the service business of the phone companies.
For his next project, Dave Hughes will be documenting the history of Old Colorado City. He's still online at oldcolo.com. That's oldcolo.com.
The FCC will soon start auctioning off a chunk of the public airwaves, known as the 700 megahertz spectrum. Free Press campaign director Timothy Carr discusses the auction's impact in this special guest commentary.
The introduction of the iPhone in 2007 promises a future where internet access is something we can carry with us wherever we go. But having the internet in your pocket raises thorny questions about the policies that have allowed cell phone companies to control our wireless experience in America. The problem is that surfing the web from handheld devices such as the iPhone will never be a true internet experience as long as powerful wireless companies dictate access. Unlike the wired internet, where you're free to surf anywhere online using the computer of your choice, open access via cell phones is not guaranteed. It is granted or denied by your wireless company. You see, for years, they have pushed a business model where they lease and subsidize handsets for consumers. A cheap phone seems like a great deal, but it's a devil's bargain that penalizes you with high termination fees, crippled applications, and gated web access. But this could change. On January 24th, the Federal Communications Commission is preparing to auction off an invaluable chunk of public airwaves that, if used right, could make a more mobile web a reality for tens of millions of Americans. In an effort to break open the wireless marketplace, internet rights groups such as Free Press have pushed for open access conditions that require all companies using these airwaves to open their networks to more devices, innovation, and competition. The FCC is showing more interest in moving in this direction as well. But the dominant carriers still call the shots, and they're reluctant to loosen their near total control over a lucrative marketplace. AT&T and Verizon are now jockeying to buy up licenses to these new airwaves, hoard access, and build new roadblocks to the mobile web. Continued pressure from wireless users and public interest groups may yet succeed in prying open a wireless marketplace, turning the buzz about having the internet into your pocket to more than just hucksterism and hype. The iPhone was our wake-up call. The coming airwaves auction is our first chance to get busy in the fight for an open wireless internet.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
The corporate media mangled Barack Obama-Hillary Clinton debate over the relative contributions of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and President Lyndon Johnson coincides with the birthday of the actual Martin Luther King. Since the corporate media is totally incapable of covering or even tolerating the raising of any issues of substance, and because both Obama and Clinton avoid real issues, real facts, and real history like the plague, we urge that thinking voters put the candidates to the Martin Luther King test. What would Dr. King do if he were alive? Dr. King said the triple evils of his day were militarism, racism, and economic exploitation. In his brilliant April 4, 1967 speech at New York's Riverside Church, Dr. King showed the interaction of all three evils in the world, that these evils work together against the interests of humanity. King declared that the Vietnam War and other U.S. wars in the Third World were evil manifestations of American militarism and an attempt to prevent other peoples from making their arrival as full men in the world, a reference to the underlying racism and economic exploitative nature of U.S. foreign policy. In addition, Dr. King said he was compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor in the U.S. King noted the shining moment when, after years of struggle, President Johnson became a collaborator with the civil rights movement, pushing through Congress both civil rights and anti-poverty legislation. But then came the buildup in Vietnam, and King knew, in his words, that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. What would Dr. King say today about the two quarreling corporate candidates, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton? There can be no doubt that he would judge them as he did his former presidential ally, Lyndon Johnson. The Iraq War has taken at least a million Iraqi lives, as the Vietnam War had killed 1 million Vietnamese, by Dr. King's reckoning, by 1967. It is an attempt to prevent Iraqis from exercising control over their own land and resources, just as King believed the Americans were attempting to do in Vietnam. And the Iraq War, just like the Vietnam War, ensures that the U.S. will never invest the necessary funds or energies to rebuild America's cities, restore the social safety net, or provide universal health care. Senators Obama and Clinton fail the Martin Luther King test miserably. Obama wants to add 100,000 new troops to the U.S. Armed Forces at a cost of over $100 billion. Even as he proposes partial withdrawals from Iraq. Clinton seeks 80,000 new soldiers and Marines. As sure as the sun rises, a bigger U.S. military means more wars and no money for domestic change. The only candidate who would pass the Martin Luther King test is Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich, whose platform for peace, truly universal health care, a living wage, and an end to corporate domination of American life harkens back to that shining moment in the 60s that King mentioned, when there were hopes and new beginnings. But the corporate media has caused the Kucinich campaign to disappear from coverage and televised debate. Lyndon Johnson finally failed the Martin Luther King test in Vietnam. Obama and Clinton have already failed the test through their own policy proposals. Neither has earned the right to speak of Dr. King's legacy. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
The New World Resource Center presents We Are Many, Inquiries into Chicago Activism. It's a series of presentations highlighting the struggles and successes of Chicago area activists and organizers looking to connect the political to the everyday. The series is held every second Thursday at 7 p.m. at 1300 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. For more information, visit myspace.com/NWRC for the New World Resource Center.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. We now feature the second of a two-part interview with the noted author, film producer, and blogger, Danny Schechter. The following interview was recorded on Sunday, January 13, 2008.
We're all concerned about our media. We know we're not getting the truth about what's happening in America. We know that politics are not being covered well. I mean, I watched this disgraceful kind of interrogation of Hillary Clinton today by Tim Russert, you know, whose show should be renamed, not Meet the Press, because Tim Russert is not the press. It should be renamed the Tim I Am Smarter Than Everybody Else show, because that would be more accurate, you know, where he tries to provoke politicians and everybody else by showing them clips of things they might have said and tries to embarrass them. In this case, I thought Hillary Clinton did well, you know, in challenging that, pointing out that a lot of the information he cited was taken out of context. But yet and still, the coverage, you know, is really insidious because we now have sort of electotainment. You know, media decides who legitimate candidates are and who aren't legitimate candidates. They cover some, they don't cover others. They're not issue-oriented. It's still more about the horse race and the polls. And even then, you know, they're screwed up. I mean, the polls in New Hampshire were wrong, and now there's a whole question about election integrity, where the voting machines tampered with there. There's the Diebold machines, which have been challenged and hacked elsewhere, you know, that were in use in New Hampshire. In other words, there are a lot of questions that just aren't being raised. There's a lot of issues that are being sidelined and marginalized. And, you know, it's a disgrace because what's democracy? If we don't have an informed electorate, what kind of democracy can we have?
Indeed, it's a very pertinent question to raise. Let me raise this question. Speaking about the media, in the past, you've raised red flags regarding media coverage, especially with the run-up to a war in Iraq, back with both in film and in print, where you basically were sounding the alarm and echoing the alarm that others had also tried to raise. Now, it seems like that it's deja vu all over again, where we're finding that the media might be playing a similarly quiescent role with regards to a possible war against Iran. Could you talk about this?
It's
what are your thoughts?
It's pretty scary, actually. I mean, I'm just looking at a report on the internet here, and I don't know how reliable it is, but it says Israel's Netanyahu claims President Bush promised unilateral nuclear bomb attack against Iran. Okay? Will nuke Iran, Bush promises Israel. And, you know, Israel has been pushing the United States on this issue. Now Bush is basically saying that, you know, our allies have to stop Iran before, quote, it's too late. That sounds a lot like what he was saying before the Iraq war, you know, that if we don't act now, there's going to be, there's going to be a disaster for the United States, threats to the world, et cetera, and so forth. All of this, of course, has been contradicted in part by the national intelligence estimate, but why let the facts get in the way?
What do you foresee as far as the likelihood of a war between the United States and Iran? Do you think it'll happen? Do you think it could be...
I mean, look, here's why I'm less alarmed about it. I think, you know, the Bush administration is sort of on the way out. Its public opinion support is minimal. It has a economic crisis that's happening on its front door. China which is the ascending power, the ascending economic power, has a, you know, does a lot of business with Iran. So does Russia. I think that they're not going to sit by and let the United States, you know, start bombing or attacking Iran. Okay, I think part of Bush's strategy, it's the old Richard Nixon strategy, where that he concocted with Kissinger, which is this, it's called the madman theory. You know, that you get your adversary to believe that you're a madman, that you're capable of doing anything, basically to intimidate them, threaten them, and force them to do what you want them to do because they feel they're dealing with an irrational maniac. You know, Nixon was threatening nuclear bomb use as well in Vietnam. You know, the Vietnamese didn't fall for it, you know, in a way. So, I'm not following this that closely. I know there are a lot of different forces, you know, in Iran. I know that the right wing in Israel is anxious for a war. The Cheney people in America wanted Israel to actually attack them, you know. Anyway, that's, you know, that's about all I can say about it right now. I mean, certainly, you see the same trend that you, you know, the same attitude on the part of the Bush administration. You knew this was coming. People have been reporting this for a long time. Seymour Hersh reported it over a year ago that the U.S. was targeting Iran. We know that this incident with the boats off the coast, you know, the ships, the so-called, you know, Iranian, you know, Revolutionary Guard, the, you know, boats there are very much, this feels a lot like the Tonkin Gulf incident, which was a fabrication that provoked the war, that led to the justification for U.S. escalation and involvement in Vietnam. So, you know, these things, nothing ever happens exactly the same way as it happened before. But yes, I mean, there is a genuine danger here. And also, we don't have a lot of people in the media that I've seen really dissecting this and challenging this well. You know, the politicians are kind of, on some level, the Republicans are outdoing themselves and they're, you know, kind of fear-mongering to some degree. And the Democrats also have to appear to be strong on defense. So, you know, you have a prescription here for more, you know, chaos and more war, potentially.
If I can change the topic to a bit more of a personal question, especially where you've been clearly very involved as far as analysis of media, producing your own media, and encouraging people to get involved in lots of different ways. And reading your biography on the Media Channel website and mediachannel.org, it is, to say the least, most impressive. What keeps you going? Where do you draw inspiration and this energy to do all this stuff?
You might be interested in, your organization might be interested in screening a film. I've made a little film about my experiences and going back to high school when I first got involved in high school journalism, and then through the 60s and rock and roll radio in the 70s and ABC News in the 80s and Global Vision for the last 20 years. So I tell that story and show some excerpts and raise questions about media activism. The film is called Putting the Me Back in the Media, A Work in Progress. It's a reference to me as a work in progress. So, you know, I feel like I've been faithful to the principles and values that I've been trying to live and practice over the years, including activism as well as journalism. You know, I've tried to combine the two in a way that wasn't, you know, characterized by just rhetoric or, you know, some sort of ideological fanaticism. You know, and I'm still doing it as best I can, but I have to tell you, it's harder and harder than ever because the support for independent media just isn't there, and it's not there from the foundation world, which did support films of ours back in the early 90s, our South Africa Now series, our Rights and Wrongs series. It's very hard for us to get funding for our film work. It's very hard to get funding to support mediachannel.org. Now one of our affiliates, the German research and its organization Media Tenor, is stepping in to administer the Media Channel because we just can't find enough funding to keep it alive. So, you know, this is a battle. This is a fight. It's a media battleground. on every level. You know, in the mainstream media, there's been a wave of increasing and, you know, serious layoffs across the country, where people losing their jobs and losing, you know, in a sense, the opportunity to work into media, just as, you know, thousands of students come out of journalism schools eager to get into the media, and the jobs are disappearing. So, it's a very hard time right now, and it's a very even harder time for independent media. Global Vision just marked its 20th anniversary, which was, you know, an achievement in our view. But at the same time, you know, we're on the verge, so to speak. You know, we're on the edge. We're trying to keep going and stay alive. So it's a battle, and it's something that I think people don't recognize the importance of, you know. I mean, every one of your readers probably buys the Chicago papers. They have no problem doing that, but the donations to independent media, they just take it for granted because, quote, the internet should be free. So how do you fund and support independent journalism? It's very, very difficult. Public television, you know, is a total disappointment. There's some exceptions, Bill Moyers being one, and, you know, the show Now and so a couple of other things. But basically, it's a disgrace, you know, compared to public television any other part of the world, where you still have serious journalism, serious independent media, I mean, independent documentaries and the like. So we're in a fight as media critics and media makers to try to, you know, do the kind of work we want to do. And we're struggling. I have to tell you, it's not easy. And, you know, it may not be successful. You know, I mean, if we don't succeed, we'll have to look back and say, look, we're amazed at what we were able to do. We're proud of it. We think it's important. And we're, you know, we've done the best we can. You know, I mean, nothing lasts forever. But I would say that this is one of the hardest times we've had, despite all of the awards we've won, despite all of the programs we've made that have been seen all over the world, despite being first with WMD on the war, first with In Debt We Trust on the debt crisis, you know, being ahead of the pack on almost every issue, working with Nelson Mandela, you know, and working with, you know, the fight against apartheid, human rights groups and the like. We're still, you know, been marginalized. It's hard to get on the air. You know, I was primetime producer on 2020. My work was seen in prime time by millions of people. This is before the cable channels were there to fragment the audience. So very big audiences. I won Emmy Awards. I was successful in a sense. But when you go outside that world and you challenge it on the one hand and try to do work that is different on the other, you know, it's tough. It, you know, we became heroes of downward mobility, you know. It's harder to survive. On the other hand, I would still encourage young people and other people to get into media, to learn skills, to find better ways of communicating their hopes, their values, and their ideas.
Last question. What's on the table next? What are you working on next? A film, a book? What's coming up?
Well, I have a bunch of different film projects that I'm trying to get off the ground. I'd rather not talk about them, largely because, you know, we've had the experience in the past of sending ideas to various networks and being public about it and finding those ideas sort of stolen and done without us. Mm. But we're trying to make some films. I'm trying to expand the web, our StopTheSqueeze.org website to do more about tracking the economic crisis. I've been doing more on trying to encourage people to be involved in this issue. I've been writing pieces. I spoke at Jesse's March on Wall Street. I spoke at his Wall Street Summit. You know, I'm speaking out on these issues also to try to show people, to try to fuse media concerns with economic concerns.
Danny Schechter is a prolific author, documentary filmmaker, media producer, and blogger. He's the executive producer of Global Vision.
My email, by the way, dissector@mediachannel.org, if anyone wants to you know, get back to me, feedback, or ask any questions.
His email is dissector@mediachannel.org, the executive producer of Global Vision, the TV and film production company, the executive editor of mediachannel.org, the noted worldwide media issues supersite, the author of many books, including Embedded Weapons of Mass Deception, How the Media Failed to Cover the Iraq War, and the producer of many films, including In Debt We Trust, America Before the Bubble Bursts, and we've been talking with Danny Schechter. Thank you again so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitchell. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
That was the second of a two-part interview with the noted author, film producer, and blogger, Danny Schechter. Danny Schechter's blog is online at www.newsdissector.com. Listen to all past episodes of The Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of The Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.